You never know what you're going to get.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Cataraqui on Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee land.
Good evening, it is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, and Ellie Sturton. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. Last week, Kingston Economic Development released a report with a strategic blueprint showing how mid-sized cities like Kingston can build their own film and media ecosystems. The Hyperlocal Ontario Action Plan, authored by Jason Jolly of Branded to Film and backed by Kingston Economic Development, Tourism Kingston, Frontenac Business Services, and Ontario Creates, lays out what's been done and what comes next to decentralize Ontario's film industry and build industries in big little cities like Kingston. Jolly sat down with CFRC and shared the vision behind the report.
What originally prompted me, and it was a theoretical exercise, is how would I build, like, how can you pioneer and build a film industry from scratch? And, you know, like a lot of folks say, well, don't we have a film industry, Jay? And I'm like, well, we have Toronto producers who will come and randomly shoot here every so often, but it's very hard. You don't really have a business model unless you can forecast it, like you can predictably do it. And so my thing was, if you want to build like a film industry, you kind of have to start with like producers and crew, and all the vendors have to be like a full stack entity in a town where, you know, that you can achieve that stuff, like where it's not just a bunch of crew members coming from Toronto that stay here and then go back every 5 days after they've done shot their limestone out and had their way.
The goal of the action plan was to create a document any community could pick up and apply to their own creative industries.
The report came out of me wanting to kind of open source what we were doing as a model. So other big little cities like Kingston could, if they wanted to look to grow their own industry, this is a different way of thinking. A lot of it was to just write a very easy to read, plain report without any, or it's more of a business intelligence paper, I guess, without any jargon. So any municipality or even someone like yourself could pick it up, but it would be very digestible. And you get a really good overview of like the history of film production in Ontario, where we are, and it's what the landscape looks like, and also how we can better support folks like myself, which is independent Ontario producers, you know, with these more affordable, efficient places to practice their productions or execute their productions.
The plan argues that the timing is right for decentralization of the industry from cities like Toronto and Vancouver. High costs and congestion in these hubs have made decentralizing production a necessity, according to Jolly.
Well, I think for anything, decentralization is something that's not just for, you know, like the film industry or even media or the creative industries as a whole. It's actually something that's an affliction of a lot of industries, which is, as you know, like when I first moved to Toronto in the early 2000s, there was like 4.3 million people. Today, that kind of greater Toronto Hamilton area is now 7.5 million. So that's a significant amount of downward pressure. And it's, you know, it's the same kind of thing that happens. Like when we were shooting, you know, we could shoot, almost get permits anywhere. It was still very like free and independent, and there was a great scene there. But as kind of the bigger like Netflix and things get gentrified, and like even if you're like, say, a visual artist, like you used to live in this industrial loft because it was cheap and nobody wanted to live in it. But now that's where they want to put a condo. So these downward pressures are something that I think affect all kinds of creative industries. And for independent Ontario producers like myself, you know, between the affordability to live, the affordability to do, because we don't have a lot of money to do a production comparatively to, like, you know, if you look at an episode of Star Trek, it's $10 million an episode just for one episode of television. When you look at our little movie, it's like $1 million for one, you know, for a whole movie, which I know sounds like a lot, but it's not. So, you know, I think in general, I think, you know, for society to be healthy, we can't just live in one place. And especially when you have such a, you know, these big little cities like Kingston are super accessible. Like, you're right in between Toronto, Montreal, Ottawa. We're about 5.5 hours from, you know, Manhattan. It's a terrific, you know, balance between rural and urban. You know, great nighttime economy, great restaurant scene, beautiful place to live. And with technology, like, it, which is very democratized now, and especially now with things like generative AI and virtual production, you don't really have to live in a big city to do high quality production. And in fact, the tools, these democratic tools, are being more and more, you know, to open sourced in a lot of ways, where, you know, that you can, I believe, and I, you know, I mention this all the time, where I believe a filmmaker with $5 million in about 3 to 5 years, whoever she is, will be able to, in a place like Kingston, make a movie that looks like $100 million today by the big studios because of these tools, and how fast these tools are you know, advancing and just being easier to use.
The report covers two case studies. Branded to Film's first feature, Dead Mother Crimson, was a testing ground. It hired 60% local crew and proved an end-to-end production could be done in Kingston. Their follow-up this year, Doom Boogie, pushed things even further. Jolly shared some of the lessons learned so far about what can be done in Kingston.
We just kind of set this random benchmark where we said, well, we're going to employ 60% locals. We're going to figure out how to either, hopefully they have experience or a little bit of experience, or they're from an adjacent industry. You know, so what it did is that first said, not only is it viable, but I think it's like, it's kind of like a skateboard trick. If you can see it, you can be it. Like, my surprise was, here I am 20 years later, and nobody had done $1 million end-to-end production, like, of, like, that was developed, pre-produced, produced. And once we were able to do that and show that it was possible to do that, I think it opened up a lot of people's eyes, including my own. It's like, wait a second, this is like a real thing now. We can do this. And so we said, well, so that taught me kind of the realization that this isn't just, you know, a theoretical exercise. So we said, here's the practical things. And we were able to train, like, some of the stuff that we were really able to learn. One of them was, we wanted to see, could we make production more sustainable, like really green production? Let's try and avoid, you know, just randomly throwing crap out, and, you know, really think about kind of how we can reduce our carbon footprint and stuff like that through little ideas or just behavioral change. So once we had done that and we realized, well, we need to do another one. And I said, well, this time, why don't we target 75% local hires? And to our amazement, and we got to 87%. We actually over-indexed. And what I found was, you know, one of the things that we really didn't do very well on the first one was, again, talent behind the camera was one thing, but we had kind of, you know, we had met like local theater actors and stuff, and theater actors and film and TV actors they're very different muscle set in a lot of ways. There's a lot of things that are similar, but there's just different ways of execution, because, you know, film is very much, you can actually whisper, where theater is it's a lot bigger, like, in terms of, so what we did is, you know, on this one, we said we need to make a real concerted effort to, tap into actors or in front of the camera. And because of this particular movie, Doom Boogie was kind of about this fictional Kingston band, we decided to look at musicians. And a lot of the folks both on both sides of the camera were actually, and again, I really believe in supporting local musicians, especially because, you know, music is a very, very tough industry. It's more than ever. And so we were able to hire them in technical positions. But what was really great is we were able to hire folks like, you know, Kira from Tiny Horse and Jonas in kind of lead actor roles. And what we've discovered there is that actors kind of have 70 or I should say, sorry, musicians have kind of 70% of that thing they need from being performers on stage to be actors, especially like film actors. So that was a great revolution. So that's something we learned on it too. And then consequently, they also contributed to the soundtrack. So we were doubly blessed with that.
According to Jolly, it's not just the lessons learned so far that will propel the industry's growth, but also what the city itself brings to the table.
When people ask, well, what's the secret to your business? I say, or what's your superpower of your business? I always say, my superpower is Kingston. Kingston's like so cool. Like, I'm sure the secret's going to get out. And it's just like what I learned was, because even on our first movie, we had like 40% were heads of department from Toronto that came and trained. And this one we had even had less. So 13%, and some of them were actors as well. So, but what's interesting is when people came to Kingston, especially technicians from outside, what I realized is a lot of people, unless you went to school here or you were born here, most people have never been to Kingston. And they've driven by it on the 401 and all that kind of stuff. But what was interesting is, you know, usually the first night, like somebody from out of town, like especially, you know, like an actor or film, was like the first thing to ask is like, where's a good place to eat? And you kind of say, well, you just open your hand and say, just go down here. And then literally the next day on set, they were like, when are you doing your next movie? How do I move here? This is unbelievable, this place, you know, from, you know, just the beauty and stuff of being in the Thousand Islands, I think. And just the general, you know, what I like to say is sometimes it's like Kingston kind of feels like it's at that kind of stage where it feels like that super cool neighborhood in Toronto, like in the early 2000s or late 90s in a lot of ways, because everybody kind of knows each other. You show up at bars and everybody's kind of like connected in a certain way.
Still, turning this potential into a sustainable industry will take work. Jolly dove into some of the work that's being done right now to bring the plan to life, as well as the challenges.
Our big focus as we really were down to is, you know, over the last 6 months, we partnered with the Tourism Kingston and are really, and also the City of Kingston in terms of, you know, we bought secured some land out in St. Lawrence Business Park, 10 acres. We've been working with a really great design construction firm. We just submitted our site plans. We're about just over, you know, call it between 75-80% finance. So we're just trying to close that last like $5 million. So that's kind of like our full court press. You know, we have a couple term sheets right now, and that's kind of, you know, just trying to find the right deal. It's been a really tough year, as you can imagine, between, especially for us, between the LA fires that started the year, and then two provincial elections, and now our provincial and a federal election, and now, you know, this wild orange man that thinks he's king yelling tariff, tariff, tariff everywhere, that's caused a massive distraction in terms of not only equity, but just getting government attention. So, you know, one of the things we are, you know, we're in discussions with the provincial and federal government in terms of bringing in some matching funds, because this is, you know, like this is creating jobs, significant amount of jobs. But, you know, that's kind of, so where we are now is, you know, we'd love to just close the financing. There's a few other kind of opportunities percolating, and, you know, we're always working with like my colleagues, in Toronto, other producers, to really lure them and kind of show them, hey, look what we did. You can do this too. You know, like, because sometimes, like I said, like that, I really believe as like a skateboarder in my youth that, you know, if you can see someone do a trick, you can do that trick too. So it's kind of like, and that's what I think. It's like, now that we've done two, it's not like the first one could have been a fluke, and now we've done a second one, and I was like, okay, there's something here. You know, within the next 10 years, Kingston has the potential to capture, you know, say 3% of Ontario's film and television. Realize that industry is $2.65 billion. Like, and of that, in terms of domestic production, which we're kind of focused on here in Kingston initially, it's about $910 million of that $2 billion is just domestic producers like me. So if we can create that new, affordable, efficient home, you know, we could see, you know, if we over-index in terms of what we're forecasting, Kingston could be, you know, like an $80-100 million industry within the next decade. It's totally doable.
To view the full Hyperlocal Ontario Action Plan, you can visit investkingston.ca/creatives. This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
This is Jesse Bell from the CFRC Sports Desk, and this is the third part of our 2025 OUA football season preview. Today we're going to be discussing the York Lions. The York Lions were the best story in U Sports football last season. New head coach Dexter Janke quite literally forced his upstart team to earn their helmet stripes and stickers by winning football games. They accomplished this with victories over Waterloo and Toronto, the first legitimate wins for the program since 2019. This York team, inexperienced and fearless, nearly managed a 500 record in 2024 after a historically bad 2023 season. York has only gotten stronger with new recruits and some key transfers, including former Queens running back Greg Jones-Sealy and outstanding McMaster quarterback Keegan Hall. This is the year that York returns to the OUA playoffs. I have them winning against McMaster in Week 1, beating Toronto in Week 3, Carleton in Week 4, and Waterloo in Week 6. I don't think they're quite ready to make the jump to join Ontario's elite, but they'll be the best of the fringe playoff teams. York is young, hungry, well-coached, and perhaps most importantly, they have nothing to lose. This is a program that has already hit rock bottom, and now they are slowly but surely building themselves back up into respectability. I've got them finishing 4-4. I've got them making the playoffs, and you'll love to see it. Folks, you'll want to check out the September 27th home game here in Richardson Memorial Stadium against the Queens Gales. That is going to be a fantastic football game between a longtime titan of the OUA and a program that has got everything to prove and nothing to lose. That's a wrap for today's sports report. Check in on Wednesday for the next edition of this OUA season preview, where we will be covering the Carleton Ravens. This is Jesse Bell with the Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. Monday, July 28th, it's going to be hot and humid in the city of Kingston. Daytime high of 28, feeling closer to 31 with a UV index of 9. 40% chance of a thunderstorm in the afternoon. Tuesday, July 29th, more heat, more humidity, and a lower chance of a thunderstorm in the afternoon. Daytime high of 28 is going to feel closer to 35 with the humidex. Wednesday, July 30th, more storms predicted for the city of Kingston, rain leading to a thunderstorm with the possibility of flooding and localized damaging wind gusts. Otherwise, it's going to feel like 33 degrees thanks to the humidex. So batten down the hatches on Wednesday, folks. Could be a stormy day. Thursday, July 31st, daytime high of 26 degrees, a beautiful sunny day here in the city of Kingston. Friday, August 1st, it's going to be 24, more sunny and clear conditions forecasted. Moving into the weekend, Saturday, August 2nd, daytime high of 25, feeling closer to 27. Sunday, August 3rd, daytime high of 27. It's going to be a beautiful, picture-perfect long weekend here in the city of Kingston. And then moving to the start of next week, the holiday Monday, daytime high of 26, feeling closer to 28 with light humidity factored in. This is the City of Kingston Traffic Report for the week. Here are the road closures for the week. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Abidon Road, Highway 2 to Middle is closed until August 15th for the removal and replacement of a culvert. Albert Street, Princess and Mac is closed to accommodate construction activity at 484 Albert Street. Berry Street, Queen to Colborne is closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Brock Street, Division to Palace is closed until July 31st from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. each day for road resurfacing. Carlton Street, Alfred de Guy is closed until August 8th for a gas main installation. Earl Street, Collingwood to Toronto is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. South Bartlett Street, Smith to Victoria is closed until August 29th for construction-related activity at 655 Princess Street. Sydenham Street, Princess to Queen is closed until October 3rd for the Sydenham Street community space. Victoria Street, Union to Johnson is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Victoria, Princess to North Bartlett is closed until August 29th for construction-related activity. activity at 655 Princess Street, and Wise Street Woodbine to Megan is closed until July 31st to accommodate construction of a new sidewalk and road improvements. Here are some other delays to be aware of. Accommodation Road, 6th Concession to White Church, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Abidon Road, Middle to Highway 2, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Bay Ridge Drive, Milford to Henderson, expect delays for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure. Catterockway Woods Drive, Centennial to Gardeners, expect delays for the construction of a new multi-use pathway. Collins Bay Road, Woodbine to Princess, expect delays while a contractor completes landscaping work on Collins Bay Road. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic is down to one lane in each direction. Gardeners Road at Centennial and Creekford, expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Garrett Road, 6th Concession to Sand Hill, expect delays while a contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Highway 2 to Abidon and St. Lawrence, expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abidon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Highway 15, Kingston Mills to Middle, expect delays for a contractor to complete work on the Highway 15 CNR overhead structure. Montreal Street at John Counter, expect delays for upgrades to the intersection, including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving, and signage to improve safety and efficiency for all road users. Victoria Street and Earl Street, expect delays while a contractor mobilizes the site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction of sewer, water main, sidewalks, and road. And White Church Road, 6th Concession to Woodburn, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract.
Now we'll take a look at some community events running in Kingston and the area this week. Starting on Monday, you've got two great exhibitions on view at the Union Gallery until August 9th. Meet Me in the Flower Bed by Mavis Chamberlain features dreamy oil paintings exploring themes of comfort and belonging. And Pillow Talk by Lynette Zhang brings together sculpture and painting to reflect on the quiet bonds between people and their pets. You can visit both shows at 101 Union Street right on Queen's campus. On Tuesday, it's time to dance. Salsa in the Square is back from 6:30 to 10 p.m. in Springer Market Square. It kicks off with beginner-friendly Latin dance lessons, followed by open dancing to salsa, bachata, merengue, and reggaeton with La Vida and Friends. It's totally free and open to all ages. On Wednesday, Games in the Square runs from 6 to 8 p.m. in Springer Market Square. Play giant versions of Connect Four, Snakes and Ladders, chess, and more. Or bring your own favorite game to share. It's family-friendly, free, and a great way to meet new people. On Thursday, Stories in the Square runs at 10:30 a.m. in the City Hall Amphitheater. This free story time is perfect for kids of all ages, and if the weather's bad, it'll move inside to the Central Branch at 130 Johnson Street. Then from 5 to 6 p.m., catch a chef demo in Springer Market Square, featuring Black Dog Tavern. Watch a local chef prepare a dish using fresh ingredients and grab a $2 sample after. Art lovers can head to Art Noise for life drawing from 6 to 8 p.m. It's $10 to join and is open to all skill levels. Also on Thursday night, the youth-led musical Merrily We Roll Along opens at Domino Theater at 7:30 p.m. This show tells the story of three friends in reverse, from success back to their dreams. Tickets are $22 to $28 and it runs through to August 9th. And if you're up for a movie under the stars, The Princess Diaries is playing at Springer Market Square at dusk. Just bring your own lawn chair and enjoy. On Friday, dust off your boots for a free square and line dancing lesson in Springer Market Square from 6 to 7 p.m. No experience needed, just show up and have fun. On Saturday, it's the return of the Princess Street Promenade from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Over 100 local businesses and community groups will fill Princess Street with deals, foods, games, and surprises. And don't miss the Montreal Street Vintage Market running as a part of the Princess Street Promenade with over 20 local vendors offering handmade and secondhand treasures. It's on Montreal Street between Princess and Queen. And if you missed the musical earlier this week, Merrily We Roll Along is still on at Domino Theater. And on Sunday, start your day with a free yoga lesson from 10 to 11 a.m. in Battery Park. Just bring your mat and enjoy some mindful movement by the lake. And if you're up for a little road trip, head to Gananoque for Molière dans le Parc at 3 p.m. in Town Park. This free outdoor performance of L'École des Femmes gives a modern twist to the Molière classic as a part of Festival. Have a community event you would like featured on CFRC's news programming and website? Contact us today via cfrc.ca.
Hi, folks. It's CFRC's Ellie Sturton, and coming up are some great live music you can check out around town this week. On Monday, Nolan Hubbard brings his smooth indie folk sound to the Cove Inn from 5 to 8 p.m. for the Monday Musical Residency. Later on, the Morning Doves take over Musiki Cafe from 8 to 11 p.m. They're a funky local jazz trio, and the show is totally free. On Tuesday, swing by Trellis HIV and Community Care between 1 and 3 p.m. for Indigenous Drumming. It's a free, all-ages gathering to share rhythm and community, and everyone's welcome. Then at 7 p.m., the Chapel Choir of Pembroke College performs Choral Evensong at St. George's Cathedral. It's 45 minutes of stunning vocals with admission by donation. Or if you're in the mood to sing, head to the Cove Inn from 7 to 10 p.m. for karaoke for a cause. It's $10 at the door and supports PAWS, Prevent Another Westport Stray, a local animal rescue organization. On Wednesday at 7 p.m., the 20th Century Band brings big band jazz to Springer Market Square as a part of the Swing and Summer series. It's free and family-friendly. Over at St. George's Cathedral, the Chapel Choir returns for another night of choral evensong at 7 p.m. Folks can also catch guitar legend Bill Frizzell and his trio perform at Hotel Wolf Island from 7 to 10:30 p.m. Tickets for that show are $99. If you want something louder, Scrams International hits the mansion at 9 p.m. with Caraba, Searing, and more. Tickets are $15 online or $20 at the door for this night of punk rock. On Thursday, Toronto alt-folk troubadour Rob Moir plays the Cove Inn from 5 to 8 p.m. with his heartfelt tunes and humor. If you want dinner and a show, Boston Pizza Kingston Central is hosting a free indie rock night from 7 to 10 p.m. with Restless Endangerment and Two Time. Meanwhile, Bill Frizzell plays a second night at Hotel Wolf Island with doors at 7 and the show at 8:30 p.m. And over at the RCHA, Beats Workin' is back with jazz and Sicilian songs from 7 to 10 p.m. Cover is just $5. On Friday, it's the kickoff of the 51st annual Blue Skies Music Festival in Clarendon, a full weekend of folk, roots, and bluegrass. Festival passes are by lottery, so email tickets at blueskiesmusicfestival.ca if you're hoping to attend. And back in Kingston, catch the Retro Kings at the Cove Inn from 5 to 8 p.m. for a set of soft rock classics and originals. Then at 7 p.m., Tegan McLaren performs a free show in Springer Market Square as a part of the Kickin' It Country concert series. On Saturday, Blue Skies Music Fest continues in Clarendon, and so do the good vibes in downtown Kingston, with Saturday sessions running from 11:30 to 3:30 p.m. in Confederation Park. See Michael K. Myers, Jeff J. Galton, and the Oscar Evans Quartet. Folks can also see Down With Webster take the stage at Base 31 in Picton at 7:30 p.m. Tickets range from $69 to $149. Finally, at the Mansion, Kingston's own Exogen plays an alt-metal set with special guest Midas at 9 p.m. It's their only show this summer, and tickets are just $10. And wrapping up the week on Sunday, the jazz brunch at Black Dog Tavern runs from 11:30 to 2:30 p.m. with Chantal Thompson and the Black Dog All-Stars. Swing by Musiki Cafe and Whiskey Bar to see Savannah Shea playing a warm set of folk, pop, and indie originals from 2 to 4 p.m. The Blue Skies Music Fest has its final day, and out in Bath, Live Music Sundays runs from 2 to 5 p.m. at Finkel's Shore Park. And out in Bath, Live Music Sundays runs from 2 to 5 p.m. at Finkel's Shore Park with Borgen and Benny, Lucanus Pell, and the Andrew Mack Band. Got a local concert or music event that you would like us to share on air? Head to cfrc.ca and let us know.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What Will I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.
You're listening to Kingston's only campus community radio station, broadcasting 24/7, 365 on 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Tune in for the best local programming.
What should you listen to make your Monday mornings that much better? Absolutely Frivolous on CFRC 101.9 FM. We play all kinds of comedy, stand-up, sketch, songs, even poetry, and the occasional interview. Mondays at 10:30 a.m. Tune in or listen to Absolutely Frivolous on our archives page on cfrc.ca.
St. Monday watches over you and me and grants the bone exhausted some liberty.
KPP Concerts has a stacked lineup of all-ages concerts happening at the Broom Factory through the summer into early fall. On June 27th, check out Housewife, followed by Friday's Child at the Broom Factory on July 11th. Then on August 10th, enjoy music from hip-hop artist Matt Mac, followed later by The Dirty Nil on September 19th. Then on September 26th, it's Petite Belle Ivoe and neo-grunge icons The Bridge City Sinners coming to town on September 27th. And then Yukon Blonde gets us into the fall spirit on September 28th. All shows are all ages at the Broom Factory and co-presented by CFRC 101.9 FM. For a complete list of shows and ticket information, visit kppconcerts.com.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, your campus community radio station, broadcasting to you since 1922.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in. This is edition 276. And on the program today, I'm going to be speaking with the public historian, Lloyd Tomlinson, about the Battle of Blair Mountain. Maybe some of you have heard of this, but maybe you also haven't, and that's really why I wanted to highlight this important historical event. And it is a major strike of coal miners that took place in the United States. It's one of the largest and most important collective strike actions in American history. And Lloyd works at a really interesting initiative called the West Virginia Mine Wars Museum. You can learn more about them at wvminewars.org. And that's a project that's been going for about a decade. The Battle of Blair Mountain is quite a layered event that took place over multiple months in 1920. It is considered one of the most significant workers' uprisings in the United States of the 20th century. This museum initiative works to preserve and uplift the voices of the people who experienced this event. Of course, this was post-World War I, where you saw a lot of veterans working in the mines and then working together to take collective action for working rights on location. Of course, coal mining being very dangerous. This is a very interesting event in American history because also we saw solidarity between different groups of workers, white European settler workers, black workers, and, you know, this is, I think, one of the very interesting examples within a region of the United States, West Virginia, where we sort of have a contemporary picture of it being a very socially conservative location without radical social movement history. And I think the Battle of Blair Mountain really pushes us to think critically about the ways that contemporary narratives work to erase social movement history. So I was really pleased to speak with Lloyd Tomlinson about the Battle of Blair Mountain and his work at the West Virginia Mine Wars Museum. And that is the subject of my conversation this week on Free City Radio.
My name is Lloyd Tomlinson, and I am the education coordinator at the West Virginia Mine Wars Museum. I also hold a degree from West Virginia University, a doctoral degree, and teach Appalachian Studies at the University of Virginia's College at Wise. So the Battle of Blair Mountain is the culmination of the West Virginia Mine Wars. We're talking about a period of roughly 20 years where West Virginia coal miners were fighting for their civil rights as Americans that were being deprived from them by coal companies under an oppressive company town regime. They're also fighting for dignity and fairness and justice in their work. They were working under horrible conditions, being paid by the ton. They could have their pay docked for any number of reasons. Usually it was just a tool for the companies to get as much out of the coal miners as they could while paying them as little as they could. And they lived under these company town rules. They were paid in company money called scrip. And they were, because they were paid in scrip, they were forced to shop at company stores where, because there was no competition, they could set the prices as high as they wanted to. And leading up to the Battle of Blair Mountain, miners in Mingo County were being arrested and held without charge by the National Guard, West Virginia State Police, and citizen vigilance committees made up of largely middle class folks from Williamson, the county seat, and people who were a little bit more concerned about law and order than they were about justice for the miners. So the final straw is the assassination of Sid Hatfield. He was crucial to the Battle of Matewan in 1920. If you've seen the movie Matewan, you've seen a depiction of the shootout that kills seven Baldwin Felt's detective agents, as well as two miners and the mayor of Matewan. In August of 1921, he was assassinated on the courthouse steps in Welch, which is in McDowell County, West Virginia. A week after his death, 5,000 miners gathered outside the West Virginia State House to petition the governor to force the coal companies to sit down and negotiate with them. The governor refused to even meet with any of them, so they decided that the only option left was to march to Mingo County armed and liberate the 120 so miners who had been arrested and bring the union with them. So essentially, the only way that they could win their union, as Frank Keeney said, was with a high-powered rifle. They are stopped at Blair Mountain by a force of about 3,000 Logan County Sheriff's deputies, state police, and mine guards. So that's a combined force of 3,000 up on the ridge. And the miners themselves were about 10 to 15,000 strong. Over the course of 4 days, they shot it out with the coal companies over top of this ridge that contained Blair Mountain. And they really sort of used a lot of the tactics that many of them had picked up in World War I. So this was trench warfare in the Appalachian Mountains. And the fight only ended when 6,000 federal troops arrived on the battlefield and forced the miners to disarm. But it is important because it is the largest labor uprising in American history. And for several generations, it wasn't really talked about. Or if it was talked about, it made the coal companies and Don Chafin, the sheriff of Logan County in particular, out to be the glorious defenders of West Virginia law and order against this mob that was coming to overthrow the state and county governments. The miners themselves didn't talk about it because they had essentially taken a vow of silence on union business, and they took that vow very seriously. So what we do at the Mine Wars Museum is we try to tell that story and make it accessible to as many people as possible. Education has always been at the core of our mission. And part of that is making sure that every student in West Virginia from kindergarten to 12th grade has the opportunity to learn about the Battle of Blair Mountain before they graduate. So we're essentially recovering and putting this history back in the hands of working people.
Lloyd, thanks so much for going over that. So let's get a bit more into why you feel doing that educational work is important in the contemporary context, and underline a bit more around the process of that shift to actually talking about this history as opposed to the silence that you described, and sort of why you feel that's important.
I think it's important in the contemporary because, well, not to get too cliche with it, but those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it. I'd take that a step further and say that those who try to control the narrative and silence history that doesn't fit with their view of the world make sure that history gets repeated. And you see that in the United States under the current regime. The rollback of child labor laws in several different states like Arkansas and Florida, the assault on labor rights under the Trump administration, and it seems not hopeless, but it seems like an uphill fight. And it's important to remember this history in order to sort of resist those fights and like fight back against these attempts to strip workers of their rights. It's easy to forget if you don't know the history that things like the 8-hour workday, an end to child labor law, and a 40-hour work week, basically like the weekend, payment in American money instead of company scrip, people died for those rights. And I think that's a big part of why it's important to teach this history. People need to know what these coal miners, these workers and their families, the price that they paid to make sure that nobody had to suffer like they suffered, and to fight for dignity in their own work.
So back to the Battle of Blair Mountain, and thanks for sharing your reflections on the contemporary importance, Lloyd. Just talk to us a bit more about the significance of this event. You described it being one of the largest, or if not the largest, labor uprising in the 20th century in the United States. You know, growing up in Canada, it's definitely something I'd never heard about. So just for people who are listening here in different cities in Canada, maybe talk a bit more about the event and its significance.
The march and the battle itself, the miners had really tried every avenue that they had open to them to win their rights before turning to armed insurrection, essentially. They had tried to organize peacefully with the union. They had defended themselves with usually armed defense, thinking about the Battle of Matewan, where they ran Baldwin Felt's guards who were evicting their families from their houses out of town. They had tried redress with the state government, trying to get them to mediate between the miners and the coal companies. And the state was so much under the thumb of the coal operators that the miners very much found themselves alone. But the significance of the march, this is 10 to 15,000, the number could have been high as 20,000 miners, in some cases their families, like there were women who volunteered as nurses at the Battle of Blair Mountain. This is a multiracial, multi-ethnic army that is marching from Charleston to Williamson, and it gets stopped at Blair Mountain. Along the route that the miners took, at the different towns that they stopped in, there were reports of black and white coal miners going into company commissaries together and sitting together at the counters or at the tables and demanding to be served. So this is in 1921. These miners are forcibly integrating segregated spaces. And to be able to pull off a feat like this and like that sort of interracial and interethnic solidarity in 1921, that was nearly unheard of, especially in the South. And it wasn't always easy. There were a lot of challenges that the miners had to overcome, a lot of divisions that they had to overcome. But they realized that despite those differences, their common adversary was the coal companies. And if they were going to have any chance of beating them, winning the union, and getting their rights, they were going to have to work together through their organization and through building what was ultimately an uneasy solidarity, but solidarity nonetheless.
Well, thanks for giving that context. Obviously, there's many political points of resonance to the contemporary context. For people who are hearing you speak about this and maybe don't get sort of the context of coal mining at that time, can you sort of locate us and describe sort of the importance of coal mining, the number of people that were involved, and also for people who are just not familiar with the sort of towns and cities you're describing? You're talking about areas around Virginia, West Virginia. Just sort of locate us just geographically in the United States also, just so people can sort of visualize where you're talking about. You mentioned Appalachia. Where is that?
Sure. So the mine wars take place in southern West Virginia in the central Appalachian Plateau. So we're talking about the eastern mountains, it's the area that is sort of bounded by the Ohio River on the western side, the Tug River on the south, the Kanawha River on the north, and I would say the New River on the east. So we're talking about a pretty regionalized area that here. It's still pretty remote in a lot of places today. And in part because of that, and also in part as a way to exploit the workers, coal companies built company-run towns. The vernacular term for that is coal camps. So they built these coal camps and basically structured everything to claw back as much as they could from the people who were working in the coal mines as possible. In West Virginia at this time, 8 out of every 10 miners were living in company-owned housing, which means that if they rock the boat a little bit too much, they can get evicted with no notice. They're consistently in debt to the companies. When they start working for the coal companies, they're issued tools that they then have to pay off from their first paycheck, which means that if they decide that they don't want to do this, they can't leave. That's how a lot of people sort of get entrapped in this cycle of debt. And they're getting paid, like I said, in scrip, which is company money. It'd be like if, let's say Amazon paid their employees exclusively in Amazon gift cards. And coal mining at this time was incredibly dangerous. This was before any sort of mechanization. The coal miners were largely responsible for their own safety, but since they were paid by the ton, any sort of like preventative work that they did, like propping the roof up with timbers, that was not compensated. They called that dead work or company work. And like I said, this is pick and shovel days. The companies really didn't invest in like mine safety really at all. And one of the places that really gets shorted is ensuring proper ventilation. So roof falls were common, less common, but more deadly were mine explosions. In 1908, up in northern West Virginia, near Morgantown, in the mines at Monongah, an explosion ripped through one of the mines there on December the 6th, 1907, and killed 361 men, primarily Italian immigrants. The death toll is probably as high as 500 because there would have been helpers, usually young boys, who wouldn't have had check tags. These are the tags that they use to let management know who was in the mines at any given moment and who to pay for the coal that was loaded. For a little bit more added context, in the 19-teens, right about 1918, a West Virginia coal miner was more likely to die in the coal mines than an American doughboy was likely to die on the Western Front. So you had greater odds of surviving on the front lines of World War I than you did in a West Virginia coal mine. And to enforce company law, the companies hired private detectives, usually from the Baldwin Phelps Detective Agency. These were primarily made out of veterans of the Philippine War, although they've sourced people from all over. But coming out of these American wars of empire, they were familiar with a lot of really unsavory tactics, and they used those extensively during the mine wars. They would intimidate miners who were found out to be organizing. They would spy on them. They would even murder union organizers. So the situation in southern West Virginia during this time is pretty bleak. And at the end of the Battle of Blair Mountain, after the miners disperse, justice really doesn't come for them until 10 years later. 500 miners were put on trial for several different charges, up to and including treason against the state of West Virginia. And some of those participants in the battle were tried in the same courtroom where John Brown was tried. For those who aren't familiar with John Brown, he tried to instigate a slave revolt by seizing a federal arsenal in Harper's Ferry. And that was one of the events that really precedes the American Civil War in a big way. So all but five of them were acquitted. Those five were convicted on lesser charges and released in a handful of years. But before the New Deal, the UMWA was on the verge of collapse in West Virginia, and it really took legislation like the National Labor Relations Act and the National Industrial Recovery Act, essentially these New Deal laws from the Roosevelt administration, to enshrine in the U.S. legal code an end to child labor, required payment in American money, maximum working hours, maximum working day, all of these things that the miners had been fighting for 20 plus years during the mine wars period. That really only comes to fruition after Roosevelt gets into office.
Thanks for sharing all that context, Lloyd. So important to sort of understand this, both this event, the Battle of Blair Mountain, but also the sort of broader context of the region in West Virginia and understand a little bit about how that's connected to a broader trajectory of U.S. labor history. You mentioned the Philippine-American War, so that would have been the Spanish-American War in 1898, around that time, I believe.
It would have been right after that. Filipino rebels who had actually fought alongside the Americans against the Spanish, when they found out that they weren't going to get independence, they were just going to be annexed by the United States, they took up arms against their former allies, and you have a years-long guerrilla war between the U.S. occupiers and these Filipino rebels.
A very important historical point for the Philippines, too. So thanks for just mentioning that. I hope people can look into it. So the last question is just about the contemporary relevance. Obviously, the region you're in has had a certain political focus in the last few years in the context of the rise of the Trump sort of type of politics. And, you know, there is this sort of strange and also understandable in a lot of ways contradiction between a certain rhetoric that recognizes working people, but then policies that have nothing to do with working people. To put it simply, I'll just let you address it. And you know, so you're based at this project called the West Virginia Mine Wars Museum, only founded in 2015. So just a note that this is actually quite a recently launched project, which is awesome. The website is wvminewars.org. So yeah, if you could just sort of frame the sort of relevance and importance of what you've been talking about, but the museum project and how that relates to the contemporary context from your point of view.
A lot of that has to do with how the museum came about, too. It's really in the 1980s and 1990s that these stories really start to reemerge. I think it really takes off after 1987. You have the publication of Denise Giardina's novel Storming Heaven and the release of John Sayles' film Matewan. Both are excellent, and I would highly recommend them to listeners. And during the 1990s, one of the founders of the museum, Kenny King, would go up onto the mountain with a metal detector and look for any traces of the battle, just anything as small as like a spent rifle cartridge, any like check tags or coal company script that may have been left behind. And he wasn't just trying to show where the positions were of the miners and the, we call them King Cole's army. He was trying to show that a battle took place here. And the thing that really sort of galvanizes the movement to get this museum off the ground, the mountain is still owned by different coal companies that have had mountaintop removal rights for the entire ridgeline, which encompasses the battlefield. About, I think, 15-ish years ago, the battlefield got listed on the National Register for Historic Places, which gives it some protection against things like mountaintop removal. The companies sued the West Virginia State Historic Preservation Office to get it delisted and withdraw the nomination, using their own sort of like crooked legal tactics, like having a petition to get the mountain delisted that had several signatures from dead people. And in I think it was 2011, a group of like-minded people, and environmentalists, historians, union miners, organized a march to save Blair Mountain, and they retraced the route that the miners took. A lot of the museum's founders met on this march, and once the march was over, they started thinking about what do we do now. And over the course of about 4 years, they built this museum. At first tried to build it closer to Blair Mountain. There were some difficulties there, securing like a permanent home. And eventually they settled on Matewan, or not settled on Matewan. It was an obvious choice because Matewan was really the epicenter of the mine wars from 1920 to 1922. Where we tie in today with not just teaching this history, but helping people within the region preserve and tell their own stories.
That was a conversation with Lloyd Tomlinson of the West Virginia Mine Wars Museum, speaking about a very important historical event of workers' collective action in the United States, the Battle of Blair Mountain. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. We broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., on CJLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Wednesdays at 8 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m., on CFRC 101.